Hello and welcome to Inside Education. Our website is insideed.com. I'm Sean Delaney and I'll be your host for the next 30 minutes. We hear a lot today about the importance of technology in education and the need to develop digital literacy among children. But sometimes it can be helpful to hear a sceptical voice, someone who challenges us and reminds us to question what our goal in education is. Such a sceptical voice came from one of the keynote speakers at this year's annual meeting of the Computer Education Society of Ireland, or CESI. And the speaker was Professor John Naughton from Cambridge University. Professor John Naughton was born, raised and educated in Ireland before moving to the United Kingdom. He is an engineer, an academic, a journalist, a lecturer, a blogger and a photographer. He is also Vice President of Wolfson College, Cambridge, Emeritus Professor of Public Understanding of Technology at the Open University, and he's technology columnist for the Observer newspaper. His books include From Gutenberg to Zuckerberg, What You Really Need to Know About the Internet, which was published in 2012, and A Brief History of the Future, Origins of the Internet. When I met up with John, I first noted that in his keynote presentation, he said that schools today are inadvertently preparing children to be losers in a technological era. I asked him why he believed that was happening.
Well, it's happening because they're going to grow up in a world which is dominated, shaped and to a large extent controlled by computer-driven technology. It may take various forms. But essentially that's what it will be, right up to the systems that even count their votes. And what I think is happening at the moment is that people have an unrealistically and uninformed optimistic view of this future, because they think, because they have seen the technology generate amazing new things, amazing new companies have sprung from nowhere to become absolutely huge, because governments and the powerful agencies in our society pay obeisance to this stuff in a big way. They're fantastically impressed by it, and there's an overriding impression that this is going to be a great future for everyone. And my considered opinion is that it is going to be a great future for a very few. And it's not going to be a great future for a lot of people. Lots of reasons for thinking that. For example, the way in which most of what people do online is effectively free work and the provision of valuable things that people don't value, like their privacy, for the enrichment of a very small elite. It's also because it's a future in which, if we're not careful, our children will grow into happy but clueless users of black box technology, which is designed by elites everywhere, elsewhere, and which they don't understand and can't change. And so it's that, and also that they might wind up with no jobs. That's a really serious problem, because the long term drift of this stuff, the direction of travel, is towards a world in which most of the work is done by machines one way or another. And then you have to ask the question, okay, well, A, what do the rest of us do? And B, what would we use in order to buy the stuff that these people, these machines produce? And not enough people, in my opinion, are thinking about this future in any serious way.
Your talk reminded me, and indeed you told a similar story today, about James Welton, the co-founder of Coder Dojo, and at a recent talk he said that lots of people are impressed when a three-year-old can manipulate a tablet or an iPad or whatever, but he said not too many people think about the engineer that made it possible for them to do that.
Yes, and not too many think about what's the prospect of that three-year-old growing up into an engineer who can do that too. I mean, some of them will and some of them do, and when they do, they'll have fantastically fulfilling and well-paid and secure existences. But most people are not like that. They're going to grow up to be hapless and clueless users of this stuff. They'll be like the three-year-old, except they'll be 26.
So what then would be a legitimate response from our education system to the swarm of technology that is descending all around us?
Well, the first thing I would say is not to be obsessed with the technology. That was the lesson of the British experience, which was that when computers first appeared and were clearly going to be very important, the ICT curriculum in British schools changed. And it seemed a very modern thing to do, so that in a world which is dominated by Microsoft and Microsoft Office and so on, that when we had an ICT curriculum, it would involve teaching students how to use this kind of stuff, Microsoft Windows, Microsoft Office and so on. There's nothing wrong in particular with that, except that it's very dated technology and will be increasingly dated. But in principle, there's nothing wrong with it. The problem was that it locked the system onto a fundamental misconception, which is that computing equals the devices of the moment. And what that meant was that every time Microsoft updated its operating system, schools, for example, couldn't afford to change to the next version of Windows and so on. So that was one fallacy. But the other fallacy was, as far as the government was concerned, is that you couldn't have something like a proper ICT curriculum, because it would have to change every time the industry changed its operating system. And therefore, the whole thing was hopeless. And so it degenerated into a kind of a terrible spiral down, which in the end wound up disaffecting the kids and disaffecting the teachers. It was an utter disaster, and it turned ICT in schools in Britain into a kind of toxic brand. But the fundamental mistake was to think that computing equals devices. And the answer is, computing doesn't equal devices. Devices are things that do computing. But computing is what matters. And understanding the way in which computers work, and understanding the way in which programmers think, so that they structure the world so that it fits programs. And they're very good at that. So understanding that kind of stuff is what you need. The example I used in my lecture was the difference between training and education. And I'm tired of saying this, but basically people didn't understand what's the difference between ICT training and ICT education until I started saying to people, OK, substitute sex for ICT and then you've got it. And that's the key element of it. Training is not what this is about. Education is what it's about. And education is producing a rounded understanding of a technology and its implications.
And more specifically, you talked about the importance of computer studies as a discipline. Could you say a little bit about that discipline and what it would involve, and if it is teachable at primary and post-primary school level?
Well, what it involves is, for example, teaching kids some fundamental concepts, which don't change. The concept of an algorithm, for example, which is a procedure for doing something. The concept of recursion, the way in which algorithms get built in like Russian boxes inside one another, and the implications of that. And you don't even have to use computers to do that. I mean, I've seen this wonderful guy in Microsoft Research in Cambridge called Chris Bishop, and I've seen him do lectures for kids. And one of the things he does is he teaches a really fundamental algorithm, the sorting algorithm, because one of the things that computers do is they sort stuff into lists. Okay, how do they do that? Well, they do it by means of an algorithm. Can you teach that algorithm without a computer? Yes. You have a whole lot of kids up on the stage. You give each one a big card with a letter on it, A, B, C, D, E, but the letters are all jumbled. You give them a simple rule for basically deciding how to sort themselves into ascending order. And the rule is very simple. It is you look at the one next to you and you do something and so on. But that's an algorithm. And at the end of it, the kids understand what an algorithm and how sorting is done.
An awful lot of people would be shocked that you can actually teach computer studies without computers.
There's a wonderful guy in New Zealand who runs a program called CS Unplugged. It stands for Computer Science Unplugged, and it's on the net. And he's produced an amazing sort of set of resources for teachers and so on. Lots of these ideas don't require computers. That emphasises the point that computer science is not just about a particular kind of machine. It's an abstract discipline with abstract concepts which have very wide applicability, and which in a way are like the laws of physics or chemistry. Not quite like that, but very close to it. That's what they're like. And if you teach, you can teach that, and it's a stable curriculum, and it's actually a science, and it belongs in any well-educated child's intellectual armoury.
But if that is to be rolled out to schools, teachers would need to learn computer science, and I'm not sure that it could be scaled up that quickly, that teachers would actually be able to learn it in order that they could teach it to their students.
Well, that is the big challenge. There is another related challenge, which is to sensitise governments, to sensitise head teachers, to sensitise school governors to the fact that this is important and needs to be addressed. But it is a big problem. It's the same kind of problem as the one that faces many countries in trying to ensure that they get a good supply of maths graduates and physics graduates and chemistry graduates to teach those subjects in school. Because one of the problems, at least Britain has had, is that many of these subjects are actually taught by secondary teachers who themselves are not qualified in the subject. Some of them are very good at it, because there's no better way of learning something than having to teach it. But nevertheless, we don't have... And so in Britain, there are schemes, for example, salary enhancement and other kinds of inducements to talented graduates in these disciplines coming out from college to consider teaching as a secondary teaching as a career. And there's no reason why the same couldn't be done for computer science.
If there was a teacher listening to us who was motivated to develop their own knowledge of computer studies, and where would you suggest that they could start doing that themselves?
Well, the first thing to do is to recognise that in this country, at this conference, and in Britain, in the Computers and Computing in Schools group and the rest of it, there are actually already really vibrant communities of teachers who are concerned about this situation. I mean, for example, in Britain, Computing in Schools came from... It's a bottom-up organisation. It came from people who cared passionately about this subject and were dismayed by the way in which, by its low status and by the way in which it was being undervalued and so on. And in the end, they banded together. They used the affordances of the net to create a very powerful online group, which both campaigns and supports. And in the end, they changed government policy. I mean, the policy in Britain, Britain's government has been changed by this. So for decades, Britain ignored and decried, quotes, ICT because of the delusion about ICT equals kit. And suddenly that idea has finally penetrated to the depths of Whitehall. It made a difference. But the reason it made a difference is because this group of teachers are very, very influential. They're very powerful. They're very committed. And in the end, because they were, in my opinion, their message was absolutely right, they got through.
And how would you characterise then what the new focus is in England, in Britain?
Well, the new focus will be, I mean, at the moment, all that's happened is that this pressure group and the people who supported it and some of the other accidental happenings that occurred, like, for example, the arrival of the Raspberry Pi computer kit, that they changed the government opinion. Now, Britain is quite a centralised society in relation to education. There is a national curriculum. The government says this is what you teach in state schools, and you have to teach it because it's part of the examination system and the rest of it. Well, so far, the achievement has been to get that changed at the top. The commitment, the recognition that computer science exists as a real thing, real subject, with real academic prestige and status, and that we should commit to teaching it to our children. That's the first stage. The next bit is the hard bit. The hard bit is first of all, alerting head teachers to the fact that this is going to be important, alerting the school governors, who are very important in Britain and British secondary schools, that this is important. And then thirdly, arranging that the kind of resources that are needed in terms of incentives for young graduates, incentives for people to retrain and all the rest of it, come into place. So this is just the beginning. and it's going to be, nothing happens overnight, and it's going to be quite a process. But it's a very important process, in my view.
On 103.2, this is Dublin City FM.
You wrote a book, A History of the Internet, from Gutenberg to Zuckerberg, and the subtitle is What You Really Need to Know to Understand the Net. In a nutshell, what do we need to know to understand the net?
Well, can I correct you first? I wrote two books. I've written two books. One of them is A History of the Internet, where it came from. And the new book is based on my reflections for years of talking to policymakers and industrial executives and having a newspaper column and so on, which is a reflection on why people don't understand the internet. And now the answer is that, first of all, almost nobody in power understands the internet. That's really weird, but it's true. And if you want a simple illustration of that, in a way, the thing that really triggered the book was my discovery talking to a cabinet minister in the previous Labour government, And I realised after a while that this guy thought that the web was the internet. Now, in terms of misconceptions, that's just about as big as it gets. And I thought, if this important, prestigious, well-educated, powerful person thinks, has that level of misapprehension, then there's something seriously wrong. And I thought, what would he really need to know? And the answer is he'd need to know a few things. Not that many, but 9 ideas I came up with in the end. And that's what the book is about. But the kind of things people need to know, first of all, they need to know that the web is not the net. It's just one thing that happens to run on the internet. It's actually not the most important thing on the internet. It never was. And when we look back on the history of the network, which is the real thing that matters, from 50 years' time, it may be that the web, huge though it is just seen as a blip. That's the first thing you need to know.
And what other kind of things do go on the internet, apart from the web?
Well, do you download music?
Yes.
Right, well, that's one of the things that runs on that. Do you do email?
Yes.
Right, do you do instant messaging? Right. There's tons of stuff that goes on there. File sharing, all kinds of voice over IP. There's all this traffic. If you want to think of it, then a simple metaphor is the railway network. Okay, the railway network has 2 components. It has the tracks and signalling, the infrastructure. And on that infrastructure, lots of different kinds of traffic runs. Different trains, goods trains, fast trains, slow trains, and all the rest of it. Well, the web is just one kind of train, right? And email is another kind of train, and so on. But the network is the internet is the network. It's the tracks and signalling. And it's far bigger, much bigger than anything that runs on it,
And why does that distinction matter?
It matters because of the architecture of the network. The network was designed with 2 basic architectural principles. The first one was that it should have no central ownership or control. And the second architectural principle was that it should be entirely indifferent to what it's used for. All it does only one thing. It takes data packets in from one end and it does its best to deliver them to the other end. That's all it does. It doesn't care what's in the packets. It doesn't care if it's a bit of an email or the photograph of your grandmother with a telegraph pole sticking out of her head or a bit of a pornographic movie. It doesn't care. If it's data, the internet will do it. Okay. Now, the point of that is that because software is pure thought stuff, you don't need any resources except cleverness and programming capacity to think up something with software. If you come up with an application, a clever idea for an application that can be done with data packets, then the internet will do it for you, no questions asked. Okay, and we never had anything like that before. And if you want an example of you could think of the internet as I do, as it's a global machine for springing surprises. There are more technical ways of putting that, but that's what the implications of the network's architecture were, that it would always facilitate disruptive innovation. Clever things that can be done with software, the network will do them. You want an example? There's a guy called Tim Berners-Lee. He's a physicist. He's in CERN, the Particle Research Lab, in 1989. He has an idea for how documents could be stored and shared across a network. He goes to his boss and he says, I have this idea. Can I have time to work on it? His boss doesn't understand the idea, but says to get him out of the room, he says, OK, go do it. And Tim sits down and with a very small number of people, no more than 5, in a year, he thinks up and he creates all the software and all the protocols and everything else you need for the World Wide Web. And then he goes back to his boss and he says, look what I got. And his boss says, well, that's very nice, but we're a particle research lab. We're not a computer science department and the rest of it. So in the end, Tim puts all of this stuff on the internet server in CERN in January 1991. Okay. And in the process, that's a single guy with an idea working for a year, and he has this idea and he puts it on the net, and guess what? The internet says, this is just data packets. Okay. And guess what happens? You have the web. You have something as big as Gutenberg. And it's all come from... Now, there are lots of other examples of that. Voice over IP is another example, where 2 guys in Estonia say, well, hey, you could use this network for voice calls, okay? And voice calls are just, in digital terms, are just data packets. So they create Skype. And guess what? The internet says, this is just data, isn't it? And now guess what we have? We have the biggest headache for the established telecommunications companies there ever was, because it's all free telephone calls across the net. That's what it means. It's a machine for springing surprises. And that's why it's really important that you understand that. And if you don't understand it, you're screwed.
You've talked about the importance of a minister in a government understanding it, but the main audience for this programme is educators. So why is it important for educators to know the difference between the internet and the web?
Well, because I said it was a global machine for swinging surprises, and I really mean that. And if you look over the years at what's happened, what you've seen is time and time and time again, major industries, major sectors of our society have not seen the surprise coming. Right? The music industry didn't see it coming. Right? Well, guess what happened to the music industry? Travel agents didn't see it coming. Guess what happened to travel agents? And so publishers didn't see it coming. And guess what's happening to publishers? In 5 years' time, Amazon will probably be the biggest book publisher in the world. Right? And at the same time as all this is happening, there's a huge business, and it's called education. We don't think of it as a business, and we think of it as a mission or a vocation or whatever, but it is a very big business, especially at university level. And it's a very expensive business. It's probably unsustainably, certainly in the university sector, it's unsustainably expensive. And then we have a technology which can do all kinds of interesting things, and it is beginning to do all kinds of interesting things. And one day it's going to have an impact also in the education field. So at the very basic level, if you were a school governor, if you were a minister of education or whatever, you have to think, what does this mean for us? And that's just a managerial perspective. That doesn't look at it from the point of view of the kids, which is what really I'm more concerned with.
So if you look down the road then, as you know, SESI is celebrating its 40th year. It's just over 40 years since you began lecturing in systems at the Open University. Where do you think things will be in 40 years' time?
I have absolutely no idea, and nor has anybody else. And that's the first kind of lesson of this. But I can see the direction of travel. And the direction of travel is worrying for me, because I think it's a great direction of travel for small elites and for the people who own the companies that control that. It's not a great direction of travel for most people. That's my hunch. I might be wrong, and I hope I'm wrong, but that's my hope and my fear. But if you want to think about this, because one of the other lessons in my book is that you have to take the long view, and we don't take the long view of anything at the moment. We're obsessed with the thing of the moment. We're obsessed with Facebook. We're obsessed with Google and so on. Nobody will remember Facebook or Google in 50 years' time. But we're obsessed with them at the moment. So I keep on saying you have to take the long view, and people say, what does that mean? Okay, here's an example of what it means. The nearest thing, we've been through this experiment once before, and the guy who triggered it was Johannes Gutenberg, the guy who invented printing by movable type. And we know when he started. We know when that started. We know when that revolution was triggered. It was triggered in 1455. We know that because that's the date of the first Gutenberg printed Bibles. Okay? Now, do this thought experiment with me. Imagine it's 1473, and you're back in Mainz, in Germany, that small town where he worked, and you're on the bridge, and you're working for Maury, the medieval version of Maury, the pollster, the opinion pollster, and you're standing on the bridge with a clip slate, right? And you're stopping people and saying, excuse me, sir, can I ask you a question? And here's question four. On a scale of 1 to 5, where 1 means definitely yes and 5 means definitely no, do you think that the invention of printing by movable type will, A, destroy the authority of the Catholic Church, 2, power the Protestant Reformation, C, enable the rise of modern science, D, change our conception of childhood, E, create entirely an unheard of professions and disciplines and so on a scale of 1 to 5? Okay, now you only have to do that thought experiment to realise the absurdity of it, because nobody in 1473 had the faintest idea that printing would do all of this stuff. And printing did all of that stuff and an awful lot more. It shaped our world for 400 years. But in 1473, nobody had the faintest idea that it would do any of that, right? Why 1473? Because we're about the same distance into the experiment with the web. So that's why it's absurd for people to pretend that they know where this is heading. We have no idea. And I think it'd be honest to accept that.
So who were the people then who survived from 1473 onwards?
Well, the scribes had a hard time. No, nothing survived. I mean, in the sense that, for example, there were no nation states before printing. There was no nationalism before printing. There was no science before printing. There was no scholarship before printing. There was none of that stuff. It all kind of triggered it. It changed the world in all kinds of ways. It even changed the shape of our brains, because our brains are very plastic structures, and they are shaped When you learn a new skill, then the pattern of network connections in your brain actually changes. So printing changed the shape, the ability to read. When you learn to read, your brain changes. And if you look at the brain structure of literate people and non-literate, illiterate people, you find a different shape. So even at that level, it actually changed us. And I'm pretty sure that this technology is doing the same, because we're learning new skills, and that's changing the shape of our brains, the structure of our brains. And there's nothing was the same again.
So as educators then, caught in this huge transition at the present time, how can we respond? What should educators do in order to give children the best chance of thriving in this unknowable future?
Well, the first thing they should do is function as intellectuals. In other words, grow up. Stop worshipping this stuff. Stop being gooey and impressed by three-year-olds being able to use Facebook and all this. Big deal. Just say, look, this is a major, this is a colossal transformation of our information ecosystem. And because so much of our society is shaped and our culture is shaped by the information ecosystem, okay, this is the scale of the thing, right? And instead of kind of parking your brains at the door and saying, oh, it's wonderful, and you say, okay, well, let's see, what do our kids really need to know then? How do we handle this? How do we think about it? Let's grow up, basically. Use our brains again, and think like adults. Most of the stuff about technology at the moment is really mind-blowing for me, because I see people who in ordinary life are grown up and intelligent and critical and very, very good at thinking about other things, but they park their brains at the door when they're confronted by an iPad or any of that stuff.
And why are we so easily seduced by the likes of Facebook or PowerPoint or Google, which you kind of gave health warnings on all of those in your talk?
I think it's something that it's an effect that Henry Kissinger observed when he was Secretary of State in the US. It was Richard Nixon, Secretary of State. And he once talked about the aphrodisiac effect of power and of money. And I've seen it time again that whenever people are and people who ought to know better, whenever they're confronted by empires, by evidence of people who are colossally rich or colossally successful and the rest of it, they actually park their critical faculties at the door. And it's really weird. But the thing that's really weird about it is that these are not impressionable teenagers fainting when they see Justin Bieber. These are government ministers, university presidents and vice chancellors, serious people who ought, in normal circumstances, to be grown up. And they park their brains out when they're confronted by the evidence of these colossal companies and the wealth that they create for themselves. Okay. So it's a kind of pathetic kind of infantile disorder, and it's affecting everybody in power at the moment.
Finally, John, if there was one message you wanted to leave behind after you leave Ireland, one message you want to leave behind for Irish educators, what would it be?
Educate our children about this stuff. Don't train them, educate them. Send them out so that they will grow up into citizens who can ask intelligent questions about this stuff.
An important message there from Professor John Naughton. Well, that's it for this week's Inside Education. You can listen to or download podcasts of previous Inside Education programmes on insideed.com or on iTunes. You can email me at the address insideeducation@dublincityfm.ie. Thanks to this week's guest, John Naughton from Cambridge University, and to the organising committee of CESI 2013, especially Anne McMorrow and John Heffernan. Until the same time next week, this is Sean Delaney signing off. Thank you for listening.